it's fun to watch adults trying to negotiate with a two-year-old on the bus who's being just virile in their behavior. Because, you know, you're not trying to raise a UN negotiator. Children don't have that intellectual capacity to be able to negotiate some of this stuff because they're not yet adults. And so we've got to think through what children are like at various stages of development so we can connect with them. We've got to understand what they're capable of doing, what they're not capable of doing, in order to teach them in a way that is most effective for their particular age group. Children are often incapable of controlling their emotions. They find it hard to communicate their frustrations, their powers of reason, their physical abilities. All of these things are in the process of developing and in the process of coming together in a way that they're not yet together. Everything that makes us a human being is coming together, but it's not yet there. So if you want to teach a two-year-old, you've got to get inside the brain of a two-year-old. You've got to understand how they respond to their environment. You've got to understand what they can understand and what they can't understand. If I were to divide my Sunday school up, I'd probably do it along these sorts of lines. In fact, it's what we do. And you'll notice there that the age group, you can span the age groups much better towards the top end because the development is starting to slow. But certainly at the bottom end, we start deliberately teaching the Bible in our church at 18 months. When the children turn 18 months, they move into that class. They take about 6 weeks to settle down. We've got a 55-week program that we just keep cycling through in that class called Bible Tots. It's available on our website. And what we do with that is we teach them God is creator. We teach them that Jesus is the Son of God. And that's all we do. And when they turn three, we move them up to the next class. On their third birthday, we say goodbye. Because you can't hold on to them much longer. There's a big difference between an 18-month-old and a 3-year-old. So we just keep moving them out. And because we keep getting them filled up from the bottom, because our church is breeding like there's no tomorrow. So as they keep coming in, we keep filtering them off the top and moving them into the 3 to 4-year-old class. Obviously, overlap is inevitable. And the reason for that is that they're developing at a very, very rapid rate. Just think for a moment how quickly a child develops in the first 4 years. They move from being the totally dependent newborn to being the highly skilled 4-year-old. That happens in 4 years. By the age of 2, they've got a brain that is 75% the size of their adult brain. It's basically a head on legs. They're beginning to they walk, they run, they climb. They use objects to represent other objects. They play. They move from playing alone to playing alongside one another, but not yet interacting with one another. By the age of 3, they have a vocab of between 500 and 1,000 words. Girls have got the 1,000 words. What boys lack in words, they make up for in the sounds of motorbikes and cars, don't they? They're adding 50 words to their vocab every month and stringing sentences of 5 words or more together. By the age of 4, they're skipping awkwardly. They've got much greater strength and endurance. They're coordination. They're drawing shapes and stick figures. They're painting pictures. They're building advanced things with Lego blocks. They feed themselves. They almost entirely dress themselves. They go to the bathroom independently. And they express a broad range of emotions that changes literally from minute to minute. It's happened in 4 years. Can I ask you how much you've changed in 4 years? I've picked up a couple of stone. But that's about it. Okay? Got a few more gray hairs. But that's it. So children are developing very rapidly. And because they're developing so rapidly, the change in the environment is absolutely critical. We've got to be accommodating them. Even a child who comes in 6 months later, it's a totally different animal that you're dealing with. And so we've got to adapt our teaching in order to connect with them in the right way. So let's think through intellectual development. Words are very, very important. They're the building blocks of human communication. Young children are adding 50 words to their vocab a month, and that means that all kinds of different words are going to be a problem. So their English words or their mother tongue words will be a problem. Every word you use in your lesson needs to be understandable to the age group that you're teaching. If you use the word well, Jesus met the Samaritan woman at a well, well, I'd imagine that in this country I'd probably need to show the children what a well is and explain how it works. Quite important in that lesson because Jesus uses that as an analogy. If I'm teaching in Uganda, I don't need to show a picture of a well because the kids know how it works because they use it every day. In Uganda, I need to explain the word tax collector because they don't understand that concept. Okay, no personal tax there. But I don't need to explain it here, because Dad curses the tax man quite often. Okay? There'll be other words like virgin. Depending on whether the children have got older siblings or not, they will tend to be more or less sexualized. So if they've got an older sibling, they're more likely to understand these concepts. If they don't understand them, how are you going to explain them? Okay? Big theological words. Sovereignty, salvation, redemption, justification, anything else that ends in shin. Okay? Are we going to spend time drumming these words into our kids, or are we simply going to explain the concepts in a way that they can understand? I'm of the opinion that we just teach the concepts. They will later on draw the connection when they see it in the Bible. There'll be small theological words, like the word grace. Grace is a small word, but it's a defining word in Christianity. Grace is the one word that separates Christianity from every other world religion, and so I want to teach it. I sometimes use words that they'll be familiar with, especially slightly older children, in order to teach and contrast the word grace. So I might say to them, there's a word called justice or fairness. All children have got a keen sense of fairness.
I was last time. I was first this time. Who got the bigger piece of cake? That's not fair. That's not fair.
Got a keen sense of justice. Justice is when you get what you deserve. I was speeding on the motorway this morning and I received a, or not this morning, let's pretend I was speeding on the motorway, and I receive a photograph of myself in my car, compliments of the government. And it says I owe 60 quid. If I go and pay the 60 quid, justice has been done. I've done the wrong thing, I've been punished, I've got what I deserve. If I go to pay the 60 quid and they say, you know what, don't worry about it, that's mercy. That's never going to happen, by the way. But can you imagine if you had to say, don't worry about it. It's okay, mate, don't worry about it. We'll just tear that one up, don't worry about it. I've not got what I deserve. I've received mercy. Grace is different. Grace is when I get the opposite of what I deserve. I go to pay the 60 quid. He says, you know what, mate, don't worry about that. That's mercy. He has 60 quid in Argos vouchers, if you'd consider that to be a gift. Yeah? I've got the opposite of what I deserve. Well, that's the gospel, isn't it? We get the opposite of what we deserve. Because God exercises his justice in the person of Jesus, we are able to receive mercy and grace, which is to be with him for all eternity in heaven instead of suffering in hell. We get the M&S vouchers of heaven. That's what we get. It's the opposite of what we deserve. To teach grace, I need to teach the concept of sin. I have to teach sin. A woman in the Southwest said to me, it's very unkind for you to tell children that they're sinners. I said, madam, what's very unkind is to not give children a handle on why they behave the way they do. Jesus says it's out of the overflow of the heart that the mouth speaks. If I don't allow the children to see that the problem with their speech or their behavior is actually their heart, that is very unkind. Because you're not allowing them to deal with what is the source and the root of their problem. And so they land up being just religious. And they have the same struggle that Paul has in Romans chapter 7. The good I want to do, I don't do. Because sin seizes that opportunity every single time. But if I can point them to Jesus, who can change their hearts, then they will be changed forever. So we need to be teaching the concept of sin. We use it as an acronym. We say it means shove off God, I'm in charge, no to your rules. Now, the reason why we do that is I'm trying to get children to understand that sin is not simply the naughty things that they do. If sin was simply the naughty things that they did, then they just need to stop doing those things. But the reality is that they can't, because it's an attitude of the heart that says to God, I want nothing to do with you. Go away. Leave me alone. Go and play in your corner of the universe and leave me alone. It's the essence of Romans chapter 3, verse 10 to 12, which is that there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who seeks God, no one who understands. All have turned away. People don't have their nose pushed up against the window of heaven. They want nothing to do with God. Okay? The one who's the seeker in the Bible is Jesus. He's the one who came to seek and save the lost. The lost don't know that they're lost. So I want to show the children that it's more than just what they do. It's what they think, it's what they feel, it's what they say. All of those things, we've been affected by sin in all those areas of our life. It's called total depravity. Every single aspect and fiber on my being is affected by sin in one way or another. And I want to show them that. I want to say to them that you're behaving this way or doing this thing because your heart is not right. In your heart, you want to be the king. And Jesus needs to be your king. Okay. Sometimes it's Bible names that are confusing. Mahershala Hashbaz, great name. Quite hard to roll off the tongue. When it comes to names, remember that children who are not seeing the name written down are only hearing the word. So if one leader says Hosea the one week, and the next week someone says Hosea, guess what? In the mind of the four-year-old, those are two different people. So we need to agree on how we're going to pronounce things, which is quite hard in a more international setting. What about Bible words, like the word disciple? We don't use that word a lot. But they were Jesus' friends, weren't they? So I can use the phrase Jesus' friends. Jesus had 12 very close friends. Of those 12, three were really close. I don't want my 8-year-olds talking about Jesus' friends. I want them talking about the disciples. And in fact, they're going to be seeing it written down. So the general rule in our Sunday school is at the age of 8 and up, we do basic Bible study. Below 8, we do storytelling. They're starting to read much younger, but they're only really proficient and helpful in a Bible study beyond 8. That's my experience. So what we're trying to do with them is by the age of 8, they're seeing the word disciple. They must know what it means, but the 3-year-old can't handle that. So the unwritten rule in the Sunday school is children under 5, we talk about Jesus' friends. Children 5 to 7, we talk about Jesus' friends, the disciples, every single time we mention the word. And if I'm doing all age work, I'll talk about Jesus' friends, the disciples, because that's the middle road. But beyond 8, it's only the disciples. There may be other words that you need to transition in this way. There'll be words that you can substitute quite easily. The word savior. The word rescuer means exactly the same thing. We don't hear the word savior or salvation on the radio. But we do hear the word rescue. In fact, we hear it most times on the radio these days. So as they're traveling to school with their parents or whatever, they may hear on the radio someone was rescued. So I'll talk about Jesus being our rescuer. He's come so that we could be rescued from the problem of our sin. Things to think about: which translation of the Bible are you using? It needs to be a translation that is readable for the children. If the teacher's done the hard work, you may know the weakness of a particular translation. But what we're trying to do in children's ministry is teach the big idea. So we're not going to be teaching any deep theological nuances that is affected by whether it was translated with the aorist perfect imperative of the whatever second conjunctive. That doesn't make a difference at all. We're just teaching the big idea. So I'm wanting a translation of the Bible that is readable for children. New International Reader's Version, Contemporary English Version. We've just gone back actually to the old NIV. The old NIV 84 has served us well, and it's still serving us well with our children. It's a good translation. Yeah. Yeah, it's probably my issues with the 2011. It's just, I have found some of the stuff much easier. But let me correct that. I probably would be using the new one, and we probably should move to the new one. But because the church invested in the new one, we've got all these old 84s kicking around. So I took that over and above another children's Bible, which I don't really like very much. I won't say what that is. But don't go back. No. If it's readable for your children, then go for it. You know, in some situations, a Good News Bible is about the best you're going to be able to do in terms of the kids' literacy. So I'm saying go for it. If you've done the work in terms of understanding the passage, whether you're teaching from the Good News or the whatever, it's not going to make a difference. Yeah. I just want the children to see that they can read the Bible for themselves. Yeah.
Quite a wide range of children's ages from 3 to 10 in one group. And I used the CIV by actually look at the passage in the message.
Mm.
And that tells me which words they won't understand.
Yep.
It's been simplified enough. Yep. I just do a word substitution.
Yep. Very good. Very good. It's a good way to do it, and the Bible Gateway is a fantastic gift. So, yeah, read it in a number of different versions, translations. Absolutely. So you can even do that as you're reading. You can say, and God made a covenant. That means a very special promise with his people. Use appropriate language at every single aspect of your lesson. So I walked into a Sunday school lesson once, and a student was teaching a bunch of five-year-olds. He's talking about Jesus in Gethsemane. He said Jesus was preparing to go to the cross. Little Korean girl shoot her hand up, and she says, "What's prepare?" She didn't know the word. She wouldn't have heard that word. In fact, I want to guess that not a single five-year-old heard that word that week. Parents don't say, "Are you prepared for school?" They might say, "Are you ready? Get ready." You should have said, "Jesus was getting ready." That's what he should have said. Okay? So we want to make sure that every word we use. And the problem is that when we're under pressure or we're nervous, we may land up using adult language, and we must refrain from doing that. So the best thing to do is to write our lessons out so we can make sure that we're using the right words. You may need to paraphrase a memory verse, so I sometimes do that. May go look at Bible Gateway, pick up a different translation, see what it says. You may merge two translations. The first one's easier with this half, the second one's easier with the second half. Have a go at creating your own nearly inspired version. If it's for memorization, just to get the fact in, then that's good. Different concepts. Children are literal thinkers. When you ask a child to invite Jesus into their heart, doesn't sound like it's a good thing to do. They're thinking in concrete terms. So you say you want to give your heart to Jesus. Well, I kind of think I need mine. So what does that mean? So we don't talk about that. We'd rather talk in terms that they can understand, that can relate to. Friendship is the currency of the playground. Sometimes you'll hear a child say, "You are not my friend," or "Will you be my friend?" Their relationship with Jesus is more than friendship, but it is at very least friendship, isn't it? We were enemies with God, and now we've been made friends with God. So instead of saying, "Would you like to invite Jesus into your heart?" I might say, "Wouldn't today be a great day to make Jesus your special friend?" By the age of 8 or 9, they're still thinking literally, but they understand that life is far more complex. By the age of 10 or 11, they begin to develop abstract thought. And they then start grasping the principles rather than just the facts that we are teaching. What God has given children is the skill of matching. So they can match something that is concrete in order to teach what is abstract. Jesus did this with Nicodemus. He said, "You don't know how the Spirit works? Let me explain to you. It's like wind. You can't see where the wind is, but you can see what the wind's doing." Well, it's exactly the same with the work of the Spirit. And so I might try to do that with some of the abstract things. Think about prayer. Prayer is weird. Prayer is someone speaking to someone that no one else can see, believing they're being heard and answered. It's weird. I might liken that to a phone. You see, you can't see the person I'm speaking to, but actually, as I said earlier, you can know a lot about the person I'm speaking to by the words that I'm using. So prayer is a lot like this. You just don't need a handset or a contract. You can speak to God. So think about how you might express abstract truths in a very concrete way for young children. We're trying to think of sort of practical everyday examples to teach these things so that they make the connection. It's got to be something that they're familiar with, otherwise the illustration doesn't work. It means that I'm going to make application for under sevens. I've got to tell them what this passage means. And we're pushing hard for people to spend 50% of their lesson with any age group in application. They must go have some take-home value. They must understand how this truth applies in various aspects of their life. With sevens to nines, I'll give one example and tell them to give me another example. With children over nine, they must give me the two examples of how it applies once we've worked out what the truth is. Okay? Details. Children don't have a filter. They've got what I call random selection. They sort of lock onto a single word that comes out of your mouth and they run with it. You're teaching Genesis chapter 3 and you mention the word snake. Snake is barely off your lips. And a kid says, my dad killed a snake. Or, I'm scared of snakes. Or 50 facts about snakes from David Attenborough. This is one of those boys in every class. Your lesson is now sitting beside the railway line. It's totally off track. Now, it would be hard to teach Genesis chapter 3 without mentioning a snake, I grant it. And I would be worried if you did manage to do that. But what I'm trying to say is that every single detail that we include in the lesson has the potential to derail the train. So as I'm thinking about my story, as I'm telling the story, I'm thinking, is this detail helping me to teach the big idea? If it's not, then I don't need it. So Jesus goes up a mountain with Peter, James, and John. There they meet Moses and Elijah. That's five names that your three-year-olds have got to get their head around. Now, was it the fact that it was Peter, James, and John that important? Not really. They were three of Jesus' closest friends. They went up the mountain. There they met two men who had lived a very long time before. The fact that it was Moses and Elijah is important in the story in the sense that Jesus is talking about his death, which is a fulfillment of the law and the prophets. But I'm not going to be going there with my lesson with three-year-olds. My three-year-old lesson is going to be that we need to listen to Jesus because he is God's son. He's the king. Okay? So the fact that it was Moses and Elijah for a three-year-old lesson is unimportant. For older kids, I will want them to know that it's Moses and Elijah. If I've recently used Moses and Elijah or taught Moses or Elijah, I might mention that. But I'm trying to keep the focus of the lesson on what's important for the main point of the lesson. What I don't want to be doing, which is a big thing coming out of Australia and it's enormously irritating, is adding detail that doesn't exist in the text in the hope that we might embellish the story and make the story more memorable. We're not trying to make the story memorable. We're trying to make the truth memorable. There's a big difference. The stories in the Bible, they will always be able to go and brush up on the details of the story. It's the truth that we're trying to drive home that is most important. Okay? So to be adding detail that doesn't exist in the text or can't reasonably be assumed in the text is a very dangerous thing to be doing. When they hear the story again told later, it sounds totally different. Okay? There was a woman who had a bleeding condition. We'll call her Helen. No, you won't. Don't do that. She's deliberately not named. The fact that she's not named shows how insignificant she was in the society because of her condition. What makes you think that you can tell a better story than the Bible writer? Or a better story than Jesus when these parables get embellished ad nauseum? Okay? And people trying to fill the time by telling the story because they're too scared to do application. So if your story goes quickly and it only takes 3 minutes to tell the story, fine. That's all right. Can you spend time applying that story or playing a game to illustrate the story? That's a far more helpful use of time. I just remember how annoyed my son was when he saw the Prince of Egypt and he said, we've just done Joseph and none of that's in the Bible. He was very, very angry that they had added detail that wasn't there. Okay? The same holds true then for the Bible study. For older ones, I'm not going to go through three chapters of the Old Testament, getting them to read one verse at a time around the group so we can expose all the poor readers in the group. And by the end of it, you actually don't have time to do the study. So I'm a big fan of what I call spotlight studies. With over eights, you are doing a basic Bible study with emphasis on basic. And so you're doing a spotlight study. If you've got three chapters of the Old Testament, you might summarize and say, look, in verses 1 to 15, this is what basically happened. Can we please have a look at verses 16 to 18? Can you give me two things we learn about God? Okay? And then this happens in these verses, and can you focus on these five verses here? Now, obviously, if it's a parable or something like that that's short enough to be read in class, I certainly would do that. I would want it well read. I wouldn't go around reading one verse at a time. Maybe someone who's competent could read. Maybe you could distribute the parts for a slightly longer story and you could highlight the different verses. You could photocopy it and highlight the verses and get the children to do it. Appoint three competent children, if there's three characters, to read the different parts. That just brings a bit of variety to the whole idea of reading. Okay? Teach one truth and teach it well. Then you will have taught 52 truths a year. Just drum that one truth in again and again and again. Okay? That's what you're trying to do. Under sevens have got no concept of time. So what's going to happen there is that when you say it was 147 years later, that means nothing to them. They cannot quantify it. They cannot imagine it. The ark was so many cubits high. Who cares? How big was the ark? The ark was big enough to hold all the animals God sent to Noah. Unless you're going to go out to a field and actually measure it out once you've worked out what a cubit is, there's no point in actually using those words. Okay? I'm talking now about younger children as we do storytelling. Okay? So to say that he, you know, it was 15 years later, that's not, you know, it was either a very short time afterwards or a very long time before. How far did he walk? He walked a very, very long way, boys and girls. He walked a very short distance down the road. Those are the kinds of words I'm going to be using with young children. Okay? So you're wanting visual timelines. We often start a series by having a key picture from some of the key Bible stories. We get the children to stand up front. We get them move around, and we try to show them where the story fits in. So I'm now teaching the Bible in terms of one event follows another event, not that big on all the dates that go with it. Okay? So I'm placing the story in the context of events. In terms of a syllabus, we're dealing with education, yeah? So we need a syllabus. We need a curriculum. We can't go teaching Genesis absolutely every single year. If a child's with you for 18 years, they've done Genesis 18 times, they've basically got a PhD in Genesis 1 to 11, got no clue who Job was. That's just no good, really. So the Mustard Seeds curriculum that we're busy with, it's going to be a four-year program. We're trying to get through the bulk of the Bible's material. The way we do it is if you had to start in September, you would teach maybe starting Genesis the first year, teach 12 weeks of Genesis, then you get ready for Christmas. You do a Christmas series. After Christmas, it's Life of Jesus. Do Life of Jesus all the way up to Easter. Beyond Easter, you're doing Acts or early church stuff, and then going back to the Old Testament where you left off. And you just keep cycling through in that way. So first year, you might do an overview of a gospel. The second year, you might do with the life of Jesus stuff. The second year, you might do parables. The third year, you might do miracles. The fourth year, you might do people Jesus met, something like that. And then you keep coming back to the early church stuff every single year because those are the events that are stuck in the child's mind. See, for the four-year-old, if you've just celebrated Easter and you've done Ascension and Pentecost, and the next week you're teaching Jesus distributing fish and bread, that's a bit awkward because has he come back from heaven for that or how does it work, you see? So we're trying to emphasize and reinforce the basic chronology of the Bible, and we basically superimpose that on the church calendar. Someone said the problem with the syllabus is it's two-thirds Old Testament. I just had to check that and found the page in my Bible that shouldn't be there. And yeah, it's probably about right. Because they're certainly not going to get two-thirds preaching. So when are they going to get it? We need to be teaching the Old Testament. Feedback. I'm trying to provide opportunity in my lesson always to see if I can test, to see if the children have heard what I think I told them. So when we communicate, there's always filters and prejudices, and we always think we're saying something, but we're saying something else. So it's important that the children provide, that I provide opportunity for the children to feedback. With very young children, I'll be using the visual aids. I'll say, can you remember what this man's problem was? Do you remember what he said to Jesus? What did Jesus say to him? What did Jesus do for him? So I'm basically getting them to give me the whole story back by using the visual aids that I've used in the lesson. With older children, you can get them to feedback by getting them to act out a scenario sometimes. Parables work really well with this. You've done the parable of the Good Samaritan. Could you say, hey, let's pretend that it's London 2016. Could we act out this parable? If this parable happened today, what would it look like? Who would the Samaritan be? Who would the Levite be? Etc., etc. Concentration. Children have a concentration span of 1 minute per year of age. 1 minute per year of age. That does not mean that the three-year-old Sunday school lesson is 3 minutes, but it means that 3 minutes, every 3 minutes, something has got to change. They don't do 17-minute monologues very well, okay? So I'm constantly pulling things out of a sensory bag. I'm constantly showing a new picture. I'm never talking for more than 3 minutes on a trot. And I might be that I've engaged them with a question. I may be that I've shown them a new picture or given them something to pass around the group to feel or touch. But 1 minute per year of age. In terms of visual aids, children are very visual, and we retain a lot more of what we see and hear over and above what we only hear. So I really want to be visual. My middle son's dyslexic, so his whole world is pictures, and it's heightened my sensitivity to the need for this in education with children. Let me give you some examples of some pictures. I need to run through these quite quickly, I'm afraid. These are high-quality CGI images. The company that produces these produces them, so it's not patronizing for younger, for older children. I don't normally use pictures with older children. I want them to have their nose in the Bible. But if I was doing a holiday club or something like that where I had all age, I might choose to use these over and above simpler ones in order not to be patronizing for older children. My issue with this artwork is that sometimes it has too many details that aren't in the text. So, for instance, there's a horse. You'll struggle to find a horse in Acts chapter 9. It's not there. Okay? Now, I'm not just being pedantic. Can I ask a question? How many of you believe that Elijah was taken up to heaven in a chariot? Chariot? Are you saying chariot because you read it or because you saw it? Doesn't matter. Sorry? You saw it in the picture. If you go and read the NIV, even the heading of the NIV says, Elijah taken to heaven in a whirlwind. The flaming chariot passes between Elijah and Elisha, and he's up in the whirlwind. His experience is more like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz than it is like Ben-Hur. Okay? Now, that's an important detail. Okay? Because I'm telling you that the reason you've all said chariot is because you saw it in poor illustrations. Now, sometimes the details that get added are very unhelpful. Jacob is busy sleeping, and he's got his head on a rock, and the angels are up and down, basically blokes in dresses up and down the staircase, and there's a wolf in the background. Why did the illustrator put a wolf in the background? Well, because Jacob was in the wilderness. How else do you pick wilderness except by putting a wolf in the background? Where's the four-year-old boy going to be transfixed? In the blokes in dresses up and down the staircase or the wolf? So sometimes pictures that offer less are actually better. So, but anyway, it's a series of pictures. You can either point out the problem with the picture, or you can just exclude the picture. Anyway, he falls from his horse. You see, that's interesting now. Is he blinded because he fell on his head from a horse, or because God blinded him? It's a question worth asking. Anyway, he's blinded, and he's led away, and he is Ananias is called and heals him. You can buy those. They're in sets. They're available there. I've been using these quite a lot. This assumes that your church is happy for you to show pictures of Jesus. Not everybody is happy with that. The blind man meets Jesus. Jesus heals him with mud and spit. He's healed. He's interviewed. His parents are brought in. They're interviewed. Can you see how many pictures I've got? I mean, that's just a zoom and a flip to get a new angle on this, okay? And he's interviewed again, and he's chased out of the synagogue. He meets Jesus. He worships Jesus. The nice thing about these pictures is the price. Every week they release new pictures. They've started releasing these ones that are more sort of photo pictures. And so I've recently used both in a talk where I did the Last Supper. And so I used the photographs to depict the scene that we're talking about, which is the Last Supper. And then I used the illustrated stuff to talk about the Exodus that the Passover looks at. So it's two different mediums in order to teach that lesson. I don't have to use every single picture in the series where the man's busy worshiping Jesus. I could become the man at the end, at the climax of the story, and be the man on my knees worshiping Jesus. I won't do it now because I probably won't be able to get up. Okay? But I could be doing that. So it's a mixed medium in terms of my teaching, and it's unexpected. You're expecting another picture, and then all of a sudden you've got me. These are just from a children's storybook Bible. It happens to have some great pictures. There's praying, there's wind, there's fire. There's people speaking in tongues. They're still speaking in tongues. They're amazed. And Peter gets up to explain, and Peter continues to explain. Okay, so lots of pictures so I can tell the story. This is fuzzy felt or flannel graph. It's dated, but it works. And it still works because you've got people who are coming and going from a particular scene. So what happens with that is, this was Philip preaching the gospel in Samaria. and then an angel appeared and then told him to go to the desert road so now I can pick Philip up and I can move him to the other side of the room where we've got the other scene set up. Now, in today's world with internet, you can just print pictures and cut them out and do it in the same way, but where you've got them coming and going from a scene, it's a very helpful way to do it. Okay, and then it's just another picture. Sometimes you've got to try and visualize the story that you're trying to teach. So the first time we did the story in Acts chapter 2, we used those pictures for Pentecost. Second time, I want to focus now on Peter's sermon on the day of Pentecost. Okay, so what I did was I said to the children, okay, today's true story's got three parts to it. The first part is something we've done before. I just did this on a whiteboard. You could use three sheets of flip chart paper to have the same effect. I said it was when those flames, you guys remember? Some of the older ones might remember. I say, great. We're going to focus our lesson today on what Peter said on that day. Okay? And what Peter did was he stood up and he said six things about Jesus. The first thing he said about Jesus was that Jesus was a man who was accredited to us by miracles. Okay? Now, alarm bells are going off in your head because I've used the word accredited. Not so? So I didn't use that phrase. I said Jesus was a man who we know came from God because he did miracles. Okay? And so I go around the room and I say, can anyone think of a miracle that Jesus did? Can you think of a miracle that Jesus did? He fed 5,000, yeah. Can you think of a miracle that Jesus did? Turns water into wine. Do you like that one? Yeah, good. Okay. I go around the room and I eventually find miracles that I can draw. That's how the game works. I can do a calming of the storm and I can do a water into wine. Okay. Let's speed up because we don't have time. He then says, but you guys killed him by nailing him to a cross, but God has made him alive again. Not only has he been made alive, he's now in heaven, reigning on a throne in heaven. And from that place, he has sent the Holy Spirit, which is what you see happening over here. These things teach us two important truths about Jesus. They teach us that he's both Lord and Christ. Those words mean nothing to children. So I've got to fill those with meaning. Lord means that he's the ruling king. Christ means that he's the promised king. He's the ruling promised king. I've written it for the sake of the older children in the group. Okay? I kept my children going for 17 minutes on the story because it was visual in this way and everybody's waiting to see how I'm going to finish the story. The people respond to Peter and they say, what must we do about this? He says, three things have got to happen. You've got to repent. I can then explain what repentance means. You're then going to be baptized and then you'll receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. You will teach that in a manner that is consistent with what your church teaches on this particular subject. Okay? And so that's what we did. And a sketch and tell. It's very simple pictures. Anybody can draw these pictures. Three sheets of flip chart paper. If you're nervous, you can lightly trace in pencil first and then go over it with a nice big marker as you tell the story. So think through how you might use sketch and tell in your illustrations. I'm wanting stuff to be sensory. I want to engage the senses. If Jesus was given something bitter to drink on the cross, well, guess what? I want something bitter for my children to drink in the class. Overbrewed green tea does the trick. If a shepherd has gone looking for a sheep, I want to spend some time thinking about what a sheep is like. Okay, so sheep's wool that I can hand around, touch, feel, just make the whole thing an experience for them. Especially stuff that you can smell, because that helps you. That's got a very good memory. Your olfactory senses have got a very good memory. You know, think of certain stories that lend themselves to sensory stuff. The story of Jacob deceiving his father Isaac. Isaac's blind. He says it is the smell and the feel of Esau, but it is the voice of Jacob. So we're thinking all kinds of things that we can do, blindfolding and feeling and touching and hearing different people and identifying them in that way. I'm wanting to engage the emotions as well. So if I can try and get them thinking about the emotional state of the person in the story, that's a good thing. If I had played a game in the beginning where I'd constantly favored one child, then they all get very irritated with that child, especially when he's receiving boxes and boxes of Smarties for doing nothing really. And then I'm doing the story of Joseph as his brothers are wanting to kill him. I now don't need to spend time in the story talking about favoritism. I've already front-loaded that idea. So I might just say to him, can you guys remember how you felt about Mark when he was getting all the Smarties? That's exactly what Joseph's brothers felt like. So at that point in the story, I'm not having to divert the story. I just flag up the emotion that they had at the beginning of the lesson. So you see how my whole lesson, everything I do in my lesson is now geared towards that one truth that I'm trying to teach. So see if you can engage their emotion. Sometimes you can get the children to guess the mood. So I might get the children to say, okay, there's a smiley face, a proud face, an angry face on the board. Can you run up and touch the one that is how this person's feeling? Or I give each of the children a set of four smiley faces that are different and say, can you hold up the one that shows how this person was feeling in the story? Okay. Just ideas in terms of teaching. We could spend a whole day on ideas for teaching. We're running out of time quite seriously. So let me just say to you, the emotional stuff's all there. Let me run through it briefly. Children under four need a very stable environment. They must be familiar with the routine. So our Bible Tots program, we do the same structure every single week. Lots of different things happening within that structure, but it's the same structure. It becomes like Pavlov's dog. You bring out a box and they know exactly what you're going to do with that particular program. The rota is problematic because they are getting a different adult every single week. So it's trying to helpful to try and think about how you might bring consistency to that program in terms of the adults present. They are pre-gang age. That means they've got no friends. Their parents might be friends with the person who attends the class with them, but they're not actually friends. Johnny's not going to not cry when mommy's gone because Sarah's there. That's not going to work. Okay, that doesn't happen. They are pre-gang. They are there and comfortable and happy because they trust and know the adult who's running the program. Five-year-olds thrive on the attention of peers and adults. They glow when they praise. They become self-aware, which is different from being self-conscious. When you sing happy birthday to the five-year-old, they want to stand on the stage and have everybody sing. They'll conduct the choir because they love the attention. By the age of 6 or 7, they express emotions physically. When they're frustrated, they hit. They become self-centered. They're constantly wanting to be first. They're always racing to the door to get first. We don't seem to change because if you go to an airport, we do the same thing. They can be attention-seeking. All right. By the age of 8 or 9, they become frustrated by trying to do things that are beyond them developmentally. They vent their anger by teasing or criticizing because they've learned that they can't hit. They find it very hard to accept constructive criticism. The smallest thing that you might mention will cause them to fall apart. Okay? So, and then by the age of 10 or 11, they're far more balanced until the hormones kick in. And then they become teenagers and we pass them on to the youth worker. And they become self-conscious. They're starting to view themselves in terms of the way that other people respond to them. Their peer group becomes increasingly important, which is really hard to teach them to be holy and different from the world. And so we've got to be sensitive to that. They don't want to be singled out or viewed as different. So you wouldn't have the 11-year-old standing on a chair so we can sing happy birthday to them. But you might do that with a 5-year-old. And that means that if you're in an all-age group, you might treat children differently depending on their emotional needs. Okay? I'm afraid we're over time, but all I was really going to say to you was to try and engage children, especially the boys, in some sort of physical activity. James, if you can bear with me for 2 minutes, I want to explain one game. We're trying to play games with kids to teach spiritual truth. So here's an example of a game that we played for Acts chapter 1. The key verse for our holiday club was to preach the gospel in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. So what we did was, those are gospel balls. The bucket is labeled Jerusalem. These buckets are labeled Judea, Samaria, ends of the earth, and that is a prison, and that is Tony, who was playing the part of an angel. Okay? So we said to them, it's 1 point for every ball you get in Judea, 2 points for Samaria, 5 points for the ends of the earth. Where is the 8-year-old boy going? Ends of the earth. Not so? Where's the 6-year-old girl going? Judea, of course. If I must, yes, you must. So they're running around depositing these gospel balls, because that's what we've got to do. And then what is happening is, while they're doing that, you've got these filthy Pharisees and teachers of the law trying to stop them from taking the gospel out. They catch them, they take the ball away, they put them in prison. Every now and again, Angel Tony releases them. This is Acts chapter 3 and Acts chapter 5. Okay? Now, I've played the game, I've taught the lesson, I've played the game. Now I sit them down and say, okay, let's think about the game. What was the goal of the game? Who was trying to stop you in the game? Let's think about the story. What was the goal for the disciples? Who was stopping them from doing that? Let's think about you. What is your goal in life? Okay, where is your Jerusalem, your Judea, your Samaria? Who's trying to stop you at home, at school, at church, in terms of preaching the gospel? So it becomes a discussion. So can you see what I've done? I've taught the lesson. I've played a game, and now I do discuss and apply. I've separated my lesson out. There's no discussion that happens in the actual lesson or story time. I bring it over so I can have meaningful discussion at the end of my lesson, and I can take a lot of time to do that and pray it through. So that's the model of what we've tried to do with the Mustard Seeds material. And if you're unfamiliar with it, you may want to go to the Mustard Seeds website that's at the bottom of your page there and just have a look at some sample lessons online to see what we're trying to do.